Today is June 29th, 1988, and I'm here with Evelyn Kosky at her home in Stark, Florida. And we're going to be talking about Polish Easter egg decorating and other types of Polish traditions there. Okay, first of all, I need your complete name for the record.
I'm Evelyn Kosky.
Okay, and the spelling for Kosky?
C-O-S-K-E-Y.
Okay. Do you have a middle name?
It's a trade secret.
Oh, trade secret. Okay. we need your date of birth and your birthplace also.
Okay, November 16th, 1932, in Jersey City, New Jersey.
Okay. And other places of residence? Quite a bit.
All over.
Okay. How long have you been in Florida here?
Just about a year.
Oh, okay.
Matter of fact, it'll be a year next week.
Oh. You've lived in Stark then, ever since you've lived in Florida? And we need your occupation also.
I'm librarian out at New River Correctional Institution, West Unit.
And your education?
AA from Warren Wilson College in Swannanoa, North Carolina. Bachelor's from Berea College in Berea, Kentucky. Master's degree in library science from the University of Kentucky. And then I've taken 9-credit courses at Copernicus University in Turin, Poland, folk arts, and a language and history and culture course at the Jagiellonian University in Krakow, in Poland.
Okay. And you're active in the Polish-American Club
there
in Jacksonville? Have you been active in other clubs across the country?
Yes.
Oh, I see. What are some of the other clubs that you've been to?
I was secretary of the club in Cincinnati and also the one in Richmond, Virginia.
Okay. I suppose you keep moving because of your different library jobs there?
Yeah.
Okay. What's your BA in, by the way?
English.
In English, okay. Okay. Any other vocations or avocations like that?
I'm a professional writer.
Oh, yeah. What particular books have you written? You have the...
Easter Eggs for Everyone, which was Abingdon in 1973, and Christmas Crafts for Everyone, Abingdon 1976. Done a lot of newspaper articles, and last fall was commissioned by the Presbyterian Church to do some curriculum writing for them.
Oh, I see.
And that material will be used as part of the Presbyterian curriculum this fall.
Okay, good.
Craft material.
Uh-huh. You've got another one that you're thinking about putting together too, right?
Two more, actually.
Yeah. Okay, great. Okay, how did you get started with the Easter egg decorating?
Actually, it was years ago when I had a Girl Scout troop in New Jersey, back in 1951. And the Girl Scout Leader magazine in those days came out with it was the American Girl, which was a Girl Scout magazine, came out with an article on egg decorating, particularly about going back into Macedonian times. And some of the techniques where you used wax on eggs, and around the same time I started being leader of a Girl Scout troop that included a number of girls who were mentally retarded. So I started to adapt the Ukrainian type techniques, which I had read about in a book that was published around that time by a Ukrainian organization in New Jersey. So I combined what I read about in the American Girl and Ukrainian techniques and adapted them, simplified them so that my mentally retarded Girl Scouts could get to use them.
Mm-hmm. And from there just kind of continued your interest in this?
Yeah, but years afterwards there was a school nurse in my high school who saw things in me that a lot of people didn't, and she said that the one thing she wanted to see before she died was me to publish a book. So she would, by that point she was around 90, going blind, and I knew that I would never be able to write a fiction book, but at the same time I was looking around for a subject that hadn't been written about, so thinking that if I picked a subject that I could research and do a really good job on, it would stand a chance of being published, especially if it wasn't competitive with other books. Mm-hmm. So I ended up with this. Mm-hmm. Took me about 20 tries to get a publisher. And then Abingdon offered to put me under contract.
Mm-hmm. Has it sold very well for you?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the Easter egg book was in print for 13 years before it finally went out of print.
Oh, great. It's in a number of different libraries too, right?
Well, the book was written with libraries in mind.
Oh, I see. Okay. You had mentioned that you were over in Poland too, where you saw some of the different Easter egg decorating. Did you go over there to kind of research it for your book at all, or was that just something that sort of fell in after you put the book together?
Actually, it was both, because I have close family over there.
Oh, I see.
And the idea was that for a while there, I was, with book royalties doing the, providing the money for it, I was bouncing back and forth to Poland at the very most every 18 months there for a while. So I've been over there 8 times within a period of about 11 years. Mm-hmm. I haven't been over there in 4 years now, and it's been it's the longest I've gone since 1969 without being over there.
I see.
But then when I was over there, partly because my family is in education over there, my uncle and my cousins knew the head of the ethnographic museums over there, I got a lot of entree into things that normally aren't open to Americans. Mm. Got a chance to visit Opochna, which is a peasant community way, way, way out in the middle of nowhere in Poland, and had the women demonstrate the egg decorating for me. Mm. They even gave me the tool they used when I came back.
Mm. What's the spelling for that particular town in Poland?
O-P-O-C-Z-N-O.
Okay. What kind of egg decorating was going on there in a Opochna?
Well, you've seen the eggs, the ones where they drew freehand within about a 15-minute period, very intricate designs on a solid color egg, dip them in one color, very intense color dye, then put the eggs on a cloth covered sheet in a fairly hot oven till the wax melted, and then you ended up with the white design on a very deeply colored egg. Mm. Most of those eggs are burgundy, purple, what have you.
Mm-hmm. Is that called the Plesanki?
That is. But
okay.
But when you're talking about Plesanki, basically what you're describing is a wax on egg technique, and it can mean a lot of things. Simply drawing the design with wax on a white egg and then having a white design on a colored egg, or starting with a white egg and then drawing with wax the part of the design you want in white and then dipping that usually in yellow dye and then putting wax over the part of the design that you want yellow and dipping that usually in red dye. And then if you have access to the black dye, drawing the part of the design that you want red in wax and putting it overnight in black dye. And at which point it looks like the nastiest looking mess you could imagine until you melt the wax off and then you end up seeing what it looks like. It's mm-hmm. almost like magic.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But all the different types of techniques used that are collectively called the Plesanki.
Yeah, it's essentially, you use a tool that is called a kiska to do basically batik technique, where you draw the design on the egg with the wax. But the name in itself really describes it, because the verb is pisach, P-I-S-A-C with an accent over the C in Polish. It's a very similar verb in Ukrainian, pisati. But no matter what the verb is, it means to write. So it literally, you're literally writing your design on the egg with wax.
I see. Okay. How is the word Plesanki spelled, by the way?
Two different ways. P-Y-S-A-N-K-I or P-I-S-A-N-K-I.
Okay. Yeah, I remember seeing it both ways. I wasn't quite sure which is which. Yeah. What other countries do this type of egg decoration to?
It's pretty common in Ukraine. Of course, over there you have the national boundary switching from with one political revolution or another. And as I showed you on some of the samples, the eggs tend to vary from region to region, and if you're really familiar with it, you can look at an egg and tell exactly where in Poland the egg came from, because the designs are characteristic of them.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that's characteristic of Polish eggs in general that you could tell the Polish eggs, say, from the Russian eggs or anything like that?
I can't, and I think it would take a scholar in that field to be able to.
Yeah.
It'd be a matter of knowing, being able to identify which region the egg came from.
Oh, I see. But there's nothing like collectively that would put the whole things together and say this is Polish.
Not to my knowledge.
Yeah. I was kind of curious about that because I was wondering if it was maybe different from some of the other countries.
From region to region, yes.
But
okay, like the, let's see. There are some Suwalki eggs in here.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's another method where you can glue on a dyed egg bits of straw and you get a result like.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Gorgeous.
Yeah. These are called straw eggs. Straw eggs from Morovia. Is this ever done in Poland?
Yeah, that's a Polish technique too.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can take the wycinanki, which is the Polish paper cutouts, and decorate eggs with those.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned about the different types of colored eggs in Poland. What are the three basic types? Or was it two basic types?
let's see. You've got the solid color eggs, which are kryszanki, the ones that are nothing but you dye them a solid color and then those are the ones that you eat. And then the pysanki.
Oh, I see.
And then the other kind that are used with different techniques were then you've got the eggs that are cut that are done with the rushes that are coiled on the eggs and then glued on.
Oh, okay, right. What's the name for those kind, by the way?
Truthfully, I'm not sure.
Okay.
Okay, something, you get a fairly strong, fairly simple egg design, and that's what your log would run into in Suwalki, which is over in the extreme eastern border of Poland. Hmm. Trying to find samples of these things, and this book isn't having them. Okay, now something like that, those fan-type designs, that would be something that you'd find in the Suwalki region.
Oh, I see. Okay. Okay, good. Had you been able to do any research to find out how far back the tradition goes at all?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it goes clear back into pre-Christian days, and egg decorating was another one of the traditions that was taken over by Christianity from pagan ways.
Mm-hmm.
The earliest that I've turned up any material on Macedonians, where they would drop threads of whey on an egg and then dye the egg.
Mm.
No, they drop wax threads on a dyed egg and then bleach the egg in whey.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd end up with red design on mm-hmm. a white egg.
Mm-hmm.
And then gradually it was picked up by Christianity. And of course, the idea of something coming from the egg, the symbolism of something being reborn.
Yeah. Do you know how it got to Poland at all?
I have no idea.
Yeah, it probably just drifting over from Macedonia, and I suppose just kind of filtering through, maybe with the trade routes or.
On this, I have no idea. All the research I've done, I haven't found anything like that at all.
Yeah, that's probably gone. There's probably almost no way of finding that one out. Okay. Do you know if there's any records that would say how far back it would go up to Poland at least?
Christianity is about 1,000 years old in Poland.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right, good. Could you kind of give me the step-by-step ways of how you go about preparing an egg? You talked about a...
Okay. If you're going to do regular pysanka, you've got three choices as to how you're going to do it. You can blow an egg. which will give you some, well, it's the most long-lasting result. You can do the egg with a raw egg, or else you can hard cook it. But your basic step is to divide the egg into segments using a rubber band to give you the divisions, and then you can either very lightly outline, draw your lines very lightly with a pencil, or else, as I was doing before, since I had a wide rubber band, using the rubber band and using my stylus on either side of it. But you essentially draw your design, get your egg divided into segments, and then from there on you just simply...
We'll get the cats meowing.
Yeah.
That's all right.
I should laughing at her. I think he's not used to having someone ignore him.
Oh, I see.
And what he wants is to come outside, and the answer is no way. But you divide your egg into segments, and then with your stylus, you draw on the part of the design that you want white. Then dip the egg in your first color dye, dry the egg real well, and then draw the part that you want the first color, which is usually yellow. Dip the egg in dye again. Dry the egg real well again using the stylus and beeswax. You use the beeswax because it has a lower melting point and it stays fluid longer. You draw the part of the design that you want the third color. And when you've got the entire design on the egg, it looks like the very devil, just this wax-colored mess. And you hold it over off to the side of a candle flame until the wax glazes over, and then very carefully you wipe the wax off the egg, and you end up seeing what your design looks like afterwards.
Mm-hmm. How many different colors would you use in something like that?
You can use about four or five if you... But something like that, you have to remember that whatever color you use over another color has to combine with the first one in order to make a third color.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you end up with a mess on your hands.
Mm. So you need to put like yellow and blue together to get green,
yeah,
or something like that.
Yeah, there's a prescribed sequence on it.
Yeah. You had also showed me some of the different symbolic meanings behind some of the patterns there.
Yeah. Before you turn it back on.
Okay, we're back to the designs.
Okay, you've got dots. They're symbolic of stars or Mary's tears. You've got a ribbon or a belt, which is symbolic of eternity, and that's one of the easiest designs to make. You've got a sieve or a net, which is a symbolism of Christ, the fisher of men. A triangle, symbolic of the Trinity. A comb or a rake, symbolic of the harvest. A cross, symbolic of Christianity. Flowers, love or charity. A pine tree, eternal youth and health. A poppy, good fortune. Reindeer, great wealth. A rooster, fertility. Fish, Christianity. Bird, happiness. Butterfly, nature and the resurrection. An old woman, just a decorative element.
Hmm. I suppose there would be some other ones too.
Yeah, that Ukrainian book that. Okay, here we go. Here we go. Yeah, okay. I was telling you about the regional eggs.
I see. Oh yeah, some of the different motifs might be use of more bands in some area versus more flower motifs,
yeah,
or something
exactly.
Like that.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. I see. There's like 18 different patterns, undoubtedly more than 18 throughout Poland for
yeah.
The different regions. Yeah. Okay. We were talking a little bit about the five, there's actually five different types of eggs. The first one is the Krasanki?
Krasanki.
Yeah. Spelled Krasanki. And you mentioned that these are the type that are just with a single dye that are brought in for the blessing of the baskets.
The red is a traditional color because you end up with, and this is, you were asking before about Russian eggs. The Russian eggs are commonly read, and they often have the letters XV on them, which means Christ is risen. Hmm. So that this is one way to tell a Russian egg. Pasanki, different ways of spelling it. Those are the ones that people commonly associate with Poland or the Ukraine. There's another kind whose name I can't pronounce, where you glue hollow eggs, or you glue bulrush pith and colored yarn on the eggs. Another kind where you either glue colored paper or straw. And Malovanki, they're eggs that have been painted with different colored patterns.
Okay.
As I said, the main one people associate with Poland would be the Pasanki.
Yeah. I went to the Blessing of the Baskets there on the Saturday before Easter, which was held at the Polish American Club, and it was really interesting to see the different eggs that they had there that were brought out.
And I was privately, this is an inappropriate comment, there wasn't a legitimate Pasanka in the whole lot.
No. Yeah, they had like some sort of wax that was or boiled onto it to make it bound onto the egg.
Of course, one thing, this basically is an art that's gradually becoming lost.
Oh, uh-huh.
The Ukrainians are a lot more for keeping it up than the Poles are.
Even in Poland?
No, in Poland, the Poles do it.
Yeah.
But of course, as women go to work more and more, you've got an additional problem on that.
Yeah.
Who has time?
Yeah. But here in America, it's being lost much more so than
I think it is, at least among the Poles.
Yeah. Do you know if other people in the club would do it at all?
Oh, I've only been in the club just a few months, so I'm not really in a position to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, none of them had really mentioned to me about them doing it.
The main ones that you'll find at folk festivals doing it are Ukrainians.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a Polish art as well as a Ukrainian one, but it seems to be more commonly associated with Ukraine.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Had you grown up with any of these types of eggs in your family at all? What was that?
I'm a half-breed and a Protestant, so no, I didn't.
Yeah, so it was more of a Catholic type thing, and then also with Polish families?
It's a part of the Polish community, but the Polish community, for the most part, is a Catholic community. I've lived in areas where they had a Polish Catholic Church, and all of these things were a part of the tradition, but being a half-breed and being a Protestant,
mm-hmm.
I didn't really have any contact with the customs until I started going over there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. How would they be used, like, in a Polish community in America? Say, like, in a church, how many, would a lot of the people know how to make these kind of eggs, or would it be kind of atypical?
I think people are getting away from it more,
yeah.
Simply because, okay, how many activities do the kids have? How many of the women work?
Yeah.
You saw yourself when I was demonstrating. It's a slow, time-consuming process.
Oh, yeah.
Most people just don't have time to fool with it.
Yeah.
A lot of them, very frankly, are intimidated by it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But you keep saying it's not that hard to do.
It's not. Because I've been in places where I've seen Ukrainian children 8 years old who are experts at it.
Yeah.
But it just depends on the emphasis on the culture. And, of course, another thing, too, though, another part of the reason the tradition, I think, is going, you've got more Poles intermarrying with non-Poles, too.
Mm-hmm.
And a situation like that, you're a lot less likely to have the traditions kept up.
Yeah.
But one of the things that really amazed me, though, the first time I went to Poland, a woman in our group, or first time I went to summer school in Poland, a woman in our group made the remark that there is no such thing as a person who's half Polish. If you have any Polish in you, you are Polish.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, it's been a very helpful thing for me to know because, okay, I'm a half-breed, but at the same time, attitude-wise, philosophy-wise, I might as well be completely Polish because basically that's what I am.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it seems really strange, though, that if you have a Pole and a non-Pole intermarrying, the Polish side seems to dominate.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in Cincinnati, we had an American who married a Polish immigrant. He was president of the Polish American Society up there. But there's some reason I can't explain, aside from the fact that Poles are incredibly stubborn, incredibly strong, stubborn in the sense of being strong. It seems to be like if you have a genetic cross between brown eyes or blue eyes, your brown eyes are going to dominate. Mm-hmm. If you have a Pole marrying an un-Pole, the Polish strain is going to dominate.
Mm-hmm. Do you think some of that is just Polish people having a real sense of their own ethnicity and then talking about it more than some other groups, or?
I think it's more than that.
Mm-hmm.
But we had the last meeting of the club was almost hilarious. We had a young woman addressing the group. She looked Chinese. She was a Chinese-Polish cross. And yet, in terms of appearance, the Chinese dominated. In terms of personality, in terms of everything she was, the Pole dominated. As a matter of fact, though, I found myself getting into trouble a lot with Anglos because of this Polish dominance. For one thing, people are constantly saying, "Now, don't get upset about something. I'm reacting like a typical emotional Pole. They think I'm upset about something, and I'm looking at them like, are you completely crazy? I'm not upset about something."
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing is that Poles tend to have a very unique, very offbeat sense of humor. A Pole will understand it, an American won't.
Mm-hmm.
But to illustrate, when I mentioned my uncle was head of the Methodist Church in Poland for a number of years, and one of the stories he told me when I first went over there was about a Russian holiday the Poles were ordered to observe. And in Warsaw, even now, you still see an awfully lot of remnants of World War II. The city was leveled, and for some reason, you seem to have there's a higher crime rate there, and almost every flat has three locks on the door. So also, there are a lot of very large watchdogs. Dogs are allowed on public transportation in Poland, so you don't need to be blind in order to get on a train or a tram with a dog. So the morning of the Russian holiday, every Pole who owned a dog in Warsaw appeared on the street with a very large bow tied to the dog's tail.
You got to explain that one to me.
Do you want me to?
Sure.
What they were saying was, shit on the Russians.
Okay.
The Russians understood it. A Pole would get by with it, a Czech wouldn't have, neither would a Hungarian.
Mm-hmm.
But this is just typically Polish humor, mm-hmm. where they can take something that is horrible,
uh-huh.
and like the red bows on the dog's tails, can get in a really nasty dig at something. But they can find something humorous in a situation.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only way they stay sane.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially like you can see the hardships during World War II. I'm sure the humor helped them to survive.
Not only World War II, right now. I remember coming back from Poland the last time I was over there, and when I got back, I did a series of articles for the Selma newspaper on what it was like in Poland 4 years ago. But the thing that, this sounds crazy, but the thing that upset me more than anything else was stopping in Montgomery on my way back to work and stopping in a supermarket or grocery shop. I came out with six lemons. Citrus fruit's unknown in Poland. The children get one lemon a year at Christmas. And yet, being able to go into the supermarket and come out with six lemons, I could have come out with 60 pounds if I'd wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
But something like that, though, that for me, to be able to go in there and buy something that to them is a luxury.
Yeah.
I stopped in the Frankfurt airport on the way over and brought boxes of German candy in. Family just went wild over it.
Wow.
Simple things that they just can't get over there anymore.
I need to flip my tape over just
okay.
a moment. We're back after flipping the tape over.
Okay.
Yeah. We were talking a little bit about kind of perceived Polish personality traits. We talked about the stubbornness as one and the real strength of character and the Polish sense of humor.
You stop to think about it for a second, though. The phoenix is considered a Polish national symbol. But you realize that, stop and think about the last few hundred years. For the most part, Poland as a country hasn't been on the map. But at the same time, there's always been a Polish identity. And Polish people seem to have an ability to bounce back that a lot of other people don't have. Mm-hmm. They have an ability to handle hardship and survive. They are survivors. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But this is just simply talking, but one of the things that is characteristic of what's going on over there right now, the sort of thing that they live with, my family has a country, has a place out in the country that originally was theirs. The government took it away from them after my aunt personally supervised the demolition of a German army barracks, the construction of a house on some land that they were able to get some money to buy. And the government eventually said that unless you farm the land yourself, you can't own it. So they had to turn over the house to a couple of middle-aged women who farm the land. My family has use of one floor for the lifetime of anyone in the family. But to get there from Turin, you ride a train 15 kilometers out in the country. And you think you're out in the middle of nowhere, something but farmland, except that if you're really perceptive, every once in a while you notice this funny-looking little box about foot high or so, maybe 10 inches wide, along the side of the tracks. You think you're going through farmland. But in the event of nuclear war, I wouldn't worry about whether my family over there was surviving, because my cousins explained to me that the funny little markers in the farmland, they've got one of the largest missile bases in Europe underground between Turin and that general area. It looks like they're farming on top of it, mm-hmm. but they have a missile base underneath the farmland. Mm-hmm. They live with that. Mm-hmm. My cousins were 9 or 10 and 13 when World War II started. They lived their childhoods either in concentration camps or hiding out in the Germans. Their children have always been a Russian combination. The family's always been teachers. And yet the younger generation has refused to go into teaching because they've Sovietized the schools. A cousin of mine right now is a mental health worker in Poland. She's early 30s. And she was in the university studying to be a teacher. Changes in the school system came about, and she changed her major. Mm-hmm. So here's a family with a tradition of education going back. My uncle was a professor. My aunt was.
Okay, today is July 4th, 1988. I'm back here for part two of my interview with Evelyn Kosky. We missed the first part because of some equipment failure, but we're back to finish up here in Jacksonville this time. And by the way, we're talking here at the Ethnic Food Festival, which is held at Coliseum. Okay, we were talking a little bit about different ways of celebrating the holidays in Poland, and you were telling me about some of the Christmas traditions before. You mentioned about the breaking of the bread that you have.
Okay, the oblaki. I said that that for me, even though this is a part of the tradition, that's probably one of the most highly maintained ones. I had never known it before, simply because I had a Protestant upbringing. But the opłatki are wafers that are rectangular. Most of them are rectangular, about 4 by 6 inches or thereabouts, and they are embossed with a nativity scene. They're made by the nuns in the convent, and they're blessed by the priest instead of consecrated, but otherwise it's the dough, if that's what you want to call it, is the same as they use in the communion hosts. And the opłatki to me would be the center of Christmas Eve, Christmas observance. The ceremony comes at the conclusion of the Christmas Eve meal. And it starts with everyone getting an opłatek. Opłatki is plural, opłatek is singular. And then it starts with the father going to the mother, telling her how much he loves her and wishing her good for the coming year. She does the same with him. and each one of them breaks off a piece of the other one, Zopuatec, and eats it. And then the father goes to everyone at the table and repeats the ceremony. And then everyone who's present does the same thing. But it's very similar to a Protestant communion service on a secular level. And then the poles, there are smaller opwaki that can be mailed. And poles will mail the things to relatives and close friends in the United States, which is their way of saying, I love you, I wish you were here. In my heart, you are. And the Americans who have close family or friends over there will do the same thing. If you're not living in a Polish community, the opłatki can be very hard to get.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they're available through the Polish groups. Then every Polish American Society Christmas party includes the sharing of the opłatki. But your Christmas Eve is a it's the peak of the Christmas season over there. It's a fast day, and everyone who is a devout Catholic completely fasts during the day, but they are cooking and cooking and cooking like crazy.
This is making all the noise.
Thank you. But everything is gearing up to a very elaborate meatless meal that begins when the first star appears. And the house is completely cleaned. They get the Christmas tree, they put it up, decorate, everything's just, you know, this big fancy table. One member of the family goes to the church for the opłatki, and everyone dresses up in fanciest clothes. Then you sit down. As soon as the first star appears, that's the point where the meal begins. It's a long meal. I think traditionally they have 12 courses to it, and the old way was to put some hay under the tablecloth to represent the manger scene, and often they set an extra place for someone who's going to be alone at Christmas Eve.
Mm-hmm.
Then if they, go ahead.
What's the spelling for opłatki, by the way?
O-P-L with a bar on it. A-T-K-I.
I was also wondering about what were some of the traditional foods served at Christmas time.
Your best bet is going to be to ask the people down there, but it runs very heavily towards different kinds of fish.
Well, boy, I'll tell you that.
Let's see, I've known like Christmas for years. They've got a cake called a Mazurek.
Just a moment.
I said I think your best bet is going to talk to some in the group because I think they observe the customs more. What I remember most of all is fish and a salad, a dessert called Mazurek, and even if the family's not doesn't drink wine, they tend to drink it at Christmas. Another thing too that's different is that. In terms of gifts, it's not Christmas isn't the big, it's not the big commercial holiday that it is in the United States. The adults might get one gift each, and what gifts are given to children. And then when the meal and the sharing of the opłatki are over, it's pretty late, and everyone who's old enough gets ready to go to midnight mass. But unless you want to stand outside on the sidewalk, if you're smart, you get there by 10:30 or 11 o'clock in order to get a seat. And then the Poles have something in the churches that is sort of interesting, because instead of having hymn books, they use what amounts to a slide projector, and they project the words to the hymns on a screen. I never saw that anywhere else.
Neither have I. Yeah. How about other Polish traditions throughout the year, special holiday celebrations?
Okay, let me tell you one more thing about Christmas, though, and this might be interesting, too. The 26th of December is St. Stephen's Day, which is a legal holiday in Poland. Christmas Day itself is an anticlimax, which you've had your big thing on Christmas Eve. But Christmas Day is family only. The 26th, everyone goes to visit relatives. They commonly, it's a very popular day for weddings. One of the funniest ones I saw was a young couple getting married, immediately followed by the baptism of their child. The other biggest religious holiday is Easter. And as you saw in the Polish American Club, the families will bring samples of all of the foods that they're going to have on the Easter table to the church, and the priest will bless them by sprinkling them with holy water.
Typically they'll fast during one of the Easter days, or they won't do any cooked food right on Easter Sunday. It's not actually a fast, it's more they just don't do any cooked food on them.
No, that's Christmas.
Oh yeah?
It's Christmas Eve.
Okay.
On the 24th of December, there's no eating until after the first star.
But they were telling me that in some of the older Polish communities that it wouldn't be a fast on Easter Sunday, but it's just that they wouldn't cook any food. So that's why they originally brought in the baskets that they'd make. Because it would be just kind of like cold cuts or something along that line, something prepared beforehand. But that wasn't done in the community.
I think it varies from place to place. So I'm afraid in some of these things I'm not that helpful because I wasn't brought up in their traditions.
Oh, that's fine. That's okay. I'm just kind of interested in your own experiences here quite a bit.
But you have everyone goes to mass. And you have this big meal. I think you're right about it being cold, though, but it's festive. And in Poland, the government will relinquish the very tight rationing. There's more food available at Christmas and Easter than there is the rest of the year.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering also about other types of traditional art, like the egg decorating that you do. Is there a special type of needlework at all that's famous in Poland?
Oh, yeah. The most impressive one is the regional embroidery. Okay, we're here instead of in my house. I could show you illustrations of some of the folk art books that I have. But the embroidery varies from region to region, and I can never remember which is Kupier and which is Kujawy. But there is an embroidery that is done on a dark, say dark brown or a brilliant orange or a brilliant turquoise background, and the embroidery is totally white. It's spectacular.
Hmm.
These were some of the things that they were teaching us when I was taking the folk arts course at Copernicus that summer.
I see. Uh-huh. Are there some other typical colors that show up in the embroidery? Are there some other patterns that are typical to the embroidery there?
I said it varies from region to region.
Yeah.
Happened was almost funny, and again, I can't remember the region. One of them was Kujawy and the other was Kupier, but don't ask me to remember which was which. I was walking down the street in Krakow one time, and I saw a skirt that was a blue denim skirt that had very brilliant flowers embroidered on the pockets. So I tried to find the shop, didn't have any luck, and the next time I went back to Poland, I took some handwork with me, and my cousin about fell over. The pattern I had found in an American pattern book was authentic Polish peasant embroidery. So here I was sitting in my cousin's flat in Warsaw, duplicating Polish embroidery. But as I said, the one is white, totally white on a brilliant colored background. The other one, I'm wishing we're back at the house now because I still have the skirt, but the most of it's done. Do you know what satin stitch is? Okay, I wasn't sure a man would.
I've talked to enough people doing embroidery that I know now.
they're primarily floral motifs done in color combinations that would almost be garish. But I've got the same flower, yellow and lavender, and a brilliant pink, and I think a blue.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all real close together, and it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. How about some of the other traditional arts? We mentioned the paper cutting before one time.
That's Vichinanki.
Yeah.
It's basically the same kind of things that the kids do. When you're in grade school and you fold paper and you cut it out, something like that, except that you make these incredible, sometimes you can make these incredibly elaborate designs. A lot of them are geometric. Others are of people, of animals, things like that. And the geometric ones are often mounted. As a matter of fact, they're commonly sold in the Sapalia shops as popular souvenirs of Poland. The only thing I've discovered is over a period of time, the colored paper tends to fade back. Mm-hmm. I've got some frame pieces at home, mm-hmm. and they fade terribly.
Are these arts being carried on very much in Poland?
To a certain extent, yes. Mm-hmm. Your best bet to see them, though, is to go into the ethnographic museums. Mm-hmm. They've got an awful good one in Warsaw, and they've got another excellent one in Toron, and I think there's another one in Lwowicz. But one of them, I think the Lwowicz one, burned down in the last few years. Mm-hmm. I about died when I heard about that.
Yeah.
I've been at the museum. The stuff's gorgeous, but it burned. But
your
best bet over there, though, is to go into the ethnographic museums, and they have the Skansens where they the one in Toron, first Toron's smaller than Warsaw, and the museum covers a fairly large amount of ground, and they brought in and reconstructed the a peasant village as part of the museum. You go in there, see the decorated chests, and see the embroidery, see how simply they lived. But one thing, though, that was done commonly in the peasant cottages, simply because you've got so many people living in the small room, they would hang a Christmas tree upside down from the ceiling. I've joked about doing it in the library at work because we're so crowded. Of course, the embroidery and the costumes are different from region to region. When I was in Opochno, which is in a province called Tomaszew, the women commonly still wear the old peasant costume, but it's this green and orange striped, fairly wide stripes, woolen. And your older women still wear the costumes. They wear them on an everyday basis. Go down the street and hear these old women still wearing them. The younger women and the children might wear blue jeans and dress like an American person would.
Yeah.
But in that one region especially, they still have the old-fashioned peasant costumes, and the women still do wear them.
How about the folk dance and folk music? Is that still prevalent?
It's maintained.
Good. Great. Is that done as kind of like a social type thing, where they get together and have neighborhood dances, or is it more of an exhibition?
I think it's more of an exhibition because the Polish teenagers are definitely into disco.
Oh, yeah. How about in America? Have you seen a lot of interest among Polish Americans in maintaining the tradition?
I think it's increasing now. For a while there, I think there were a lot of others who felt the same way I did. You were not proud of your ancestry, and you tried to deliberately hide it, but now... our club is small, but there are still a pretty fair number of people who are interested in maintaining it and bringing the customs on down. But this lady I was talking to in there when we were frying pierogies before said that her experiences were the same basically as mine. The older people kept the language. My grandmother was in the United States probably 60 years before she died. She would not speak English. So her children would never speak English to her because if she understood, she wouldn't answer you anyway. But her children's Polish was very bad, according to my uncle the professor. And my one cousin in this country refused to have anything to do with the language. And then I went back when I was in my mid-30s after having been to Poland the first time and was so fascinated by it that I went back and took two back-to-back correspondence courses in the language from the University of Minnesota. So that I've worked with the language, but for me it's been an interest, it's been a hobby, and I had the interest and the willingness to stick with it But I have what's called a passing knowledge of the language. I have a hard time understanding it, and when I speak it at all, it tends to be with what people say is an Appalachian accent. Uh-huh. But if I can be in Poland away from English-speaking relatives, I can pick it up pretty quickly.
Awesome.
But I think your average, the average person in the younger generation, in part because there's so much intermarriage, doesn't know the language.
Yeah. You mentioned that part of the reason why you weren't interested or couldn't display any interest in your Polish ethnicity was because you grew up during World War II.
Yeah. It wasn't as much that as was that we were living in New Jersey in an Anglo community, and the Anglo community wouldn't accept us because my father's name is Polish, and the Poles wouldn't accept us because in those days being Protestant was about, that would be about the equivalent of George Wallace's daughter marrying a black person. Mm-hmm. I think it's changed visibly for the better now. Mm-hmm. But for years there was a lot of bias. If you were Polish, you pretty much had to stick to a Polish community, and if you were Protestant, you weren't wanted by anyone. Mm-hmm. I'm not noticing this now anywhere near the extent that I did when I was in Cincinnati. Several of the major officers of our Polish American Society, which was a lot larger than this one, were Protestants.
Let's see. Also, I'm wondering about the book that you wrote. I was wondering if you've gotten a lot of response from your readers about that. Have they gotten in touch with you?
A few have. It's gotten a lot of attention from... Okay. There's a yes and a no answer to your question. The Kosciuszko Society, which is the main Polish ethnic group in the United States, is New York-based, and they included my books on their bibliographies of material that they were recommending to the Polish American community. So I guess yes.
Okay. Have you ever done any seminars in the egg decorating as a result of the book?
I've taught a lot of workshops. Let's see. Okay, I did two this spring that were kind of fun, and they were kind of opposite. I did one in Stark for the Homemakers Club, and then because a friend of mine is director of libraries up at Florida State Hospital, the mental hospital in Chattanooga, I went up there on Palm Sunday weekend and did a Pasanke decorating workshop for her recreation therapist, and a number of the inmates wandered in, so the inmates got in.
That's good. Yeah. How about with the Polish American Club? Have you done any workshops with them on Pasanke?
Not so far.
It'd be kind of fun.
Yeah,
they would. Yeah. You should suggest that for an activity that could be coming here.
I hope I'm going to be in Orlando. I don't know yet.
Yeah.
Strictly as an aside, I've got my evaluation, and hopefully I'll get to go to Orlando, maybe.
Well, good luck with it. Okay. Well, I'm just about out of tape here. Do you have anything like that?
Not really.
Are there other things that you'd recommend I'd look for in the working in researching the Polish community and the different types of traditional arts or music or anything along like that? Are there some must researches, kind of like a must see or something like that?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
I would recommend that you talk to some of the old-time boys who are Roman Catholics. I think they could give you an aspect of it that I couldn't, simply because, as I said, I was brought up in a non-Polish environment and I was not Polish. Mm.
Were there some Catholic things that you were introduced to?
And there are some of the Catholic things, the obłoki, for example. My Christmas isn't Christmas unless I get an obłoki from Poland. Mm-hmm. And my family's weird anyway, because when I'm in Poland, I go to Mass with the family. In the United States, I'm a Protestant. And yet, when my uncle was head of the Methodist Church over there, his Methodist headquarters were right across from the Catholic Church. So my devoutly Catholic aunt would go to the Methodist ceremony, Methodist Church with my uncle, and then go across the street to Mass. We do it both ways.
That's it. Okay. All right, well, thanks for your help.
Well,
I appreciate
you. I appreciate it.